Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 376, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you'd like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is Jason Heaton, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, James Stacey. James, how are we doing today? And you're back after a long Canadian holiday weekend, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, and back after the Victoria Day long weekend. Got back from the cottage last night. It was good. It was nice to get up there. I had a very busy week last week with some travel to a part of the world that turns out is very difficult to get to from Toronto. But we'll get into that in just a moment. But yeah, I went up to the cottage. Just kind of kicked it off for the season. It was a couple of really warm, sunny days. Felt like proper summer. And then, of course, once you jump into the lake, you realize, oh, no, it's still May. we believe the lake to have been about 8 Celsius. So we had a couple of nice little swims, but nobody was staying in very long. But I was pleased and impressed that my daughters were willing to get in when the water was kind of that cold. Some years it's warmer than this. It was a very late spring this year.
Yeah,
I think the thaw wasn't even necessarily that long ago.
Yeah.
In terms of the lake thawing out. It was a fun one. Great to be up there. Looking forward to spending as much of my summer up there as I possibly can. So yeah, it was good. How about you? How have you been since we chatted last?
I've been good. Any bugs there yet? We haven't really seen any.
Dude, tons of ticks.
Oh, yeah, ticks.
Like in hours, we realized it was going to be a different beast than last year.
Mm.
And yeah, I only just turned on the Dynatrap, so I can't really comment on its efficacy just yet. It needs time to run. But I can tell you that, I mean, from the knees down, dude, I am one big mosquito bite on both legs.
Oh, man. Wow. Oh, boy.
So we'll have to look into maybe a couple other options. I've seen those like mosquito buckets you can make.
Huh.
Where you drop the kind of puck in with water and leaves and other stuff and then kind of put them around the property.
Huh.
And those apparently, at least from what I've read, are quite effective.
Hmm.
So that could be an option that I might have to look into as you know, it's definitely unpleasant. And the tick thing is just, I think, something we all have to live with now.
Yeah.
You do need to, if you live in an area that now has ticks, you need to become like tick knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
Try and keep the kids in relatively short grass unless they're properly clothed, I guess, right?
Yeah, I know. We experienced tick issues out in California a couple of weeks ago, and also poison oak, and not to a lesser degree out there, poison ivy. But
not fun.
The tick thing is troubling to me. You know, here in Minnesota, obviously it's a big thing as well. We have a similar climate to you, and yeah, they're already out in force, and you're seeing a lot more warnings. And I just think, spring is different these days than it used to be, and they're just everywhere. So it is a bummer. Yeah. And this weekend is the long weekend coming up here in the U.S., Memorial Day, of course. And, we have kind of not cottage kind of weekend, but we are going to visit, some friends, Saturday, Sunday they do an annual float down a river called the Kettle River, kayaks and canoes and that sort of thing they've got like a vacation place up there and, they invite friends and we're going to sleep overnight in the Defender and they're out in their property and do some kayaking. So yeah, it'll be fun, but I'm sure we'll have to keep an eye out for the critters as well, the ticks. But I also jumped in the water this past weekend. You know, I've got this, I talked about it a while back. I'm doing the Pointe to La Pointe 2 mile Lake Superior swim on August 1st. And that's coming up. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think that, you know, because we're having a pretty chilly day here. It's probably 10 degrees C here today with a high of about 15. I mean, it's remarkably cool and I'm fighting the urge to turn the heat on in the house again, but I got to get training. I've got to get in the water. I've been doing strength training and running a lot this winter and spring, but I've got to get some swim time in. So I decided to swim across the lake just down the street from my house here on Saturday morning. And so I went over there and Christy escorted me in a kayak, you know, just to make sure I didn't get mowed down by a boat, et cetera. But I, you know, wore a wetsuit and neoprene socks and a neoprene hood because the water was cold, but
yeah, for sure.
It felt good. It felt pretty good to do. I did about 2/3 of a mile. I've got
I'm glad.
Some work to do, but summer's off to a bit of a slow start here. I guess it's not quite summer, but after this weekend, it's kind of the official kickoff for it.
For sure. Yeah, we were lucky. It's quite warm. It's quite warm again today. We're up in the very high 20s, low 30s, which puts us in the 80s to 90s here. for Fahrenheit. But yeah, the swim season is something you do have to prep for. We're prepping in a little bit of a different way. My son, who's now 10 months, has been in swim lessons for a while, like the last several months. And our hope being that by the time his little body could, you know, appropriately handle the cold, he'll be quite water comfortable.
To
kind of splash around at the cottage. So we'll see how that pays off. He really likes the pool at our local dive shop. So that's been a real plus for him on a weekly level. Huh. He's just a little frog in there. So it's a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah. Other than all that news, I managed to, you know, every once in a while we get that itch to kind of trim down the collection a little bit, the watch collection. And
sure.
I did some of that yesterday. I put a few watches up for sale and, got some bites and shipping off a bunch this afternoon. So, you know, it's a weird hobby. It's a weird mindset to be in, you know, this kind of begrudgingly calling myself a collector over the years, but to be a collector and then to have this sort of persistent urge to like thin down. Mm-hmm. And then after doing it, kind of feeling just almost, you know, literally lighter, you know, for having done that. And they're all going to good homes, and I'm excited for the folks that are getting these, and there's some nice pieces in there. But it felt good to do that. The impetus for that was I've got a couple of watches out for service that as I'm looking at the pending bills for those, I was like, I need to raise some funds here because, you know, watch servicing is not cheap.
Got yourself a quote scare.
Yeah.
It's a timely thing to talk about ways that we try and keep this hobby fun. After some of the drama of this past weekend, both within the watch enthusiast community and around it, I guess.
Yeah.
But we can get into that in sort of the main check. The one thing we did want to add is we are planning to do an event at Wind Up Chicago with Citizen, as we have in the past. This year, it's looking as though it'll be Friday evening. So I'm sure there'll be other events going on Friday evening. That's okay. We'll be at the show at least for part of Saturday as well, kind of hanging out. But that would be Friday the 10th. Please stay tuned to these programs for more details. And if you're on the Slack, that'll give you the first crack at an RSVP. Just make sure that you're in the meetups channel, which is where we'll drop that RSVP or even just details if we're not doing an RSVP, just the details of where to show up.
Yeah.
But the goal would be to, you know, a couple hours of a hangout and some beer and pizza and that sort of thing, or some sort of food. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But it should be a nice casual event. If you're used to coming to our things, it'll be the same sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely should be fun. I mean, we deliberately try to kind of underplan these events just so it's a time and a place to be, and then leave the rest of it to everybody's kind of personalities and allow people to just kind of hang out and socialize, and that always makes it a fun event. So we do have a meeting with Citizen right after we're done recording here today to kind of start to firm up some details, and so that'll be forthcoming on Slack.
All right, nice. Well, look, before we get into what's sort of going to be a loose, rambly sort of catch-up show on a handful of topics and kind of things we've been up to for the last little while, you want to dig into some wrist check?
Yeah. As part of my kind of watch collection purge, I was, you know, going through my watch box and pulling out some pieces and swapping straps around to kind of rekindle some interest in a few that I don't wear much. And one of those was my Aquastar Deep Star, the original, you know, reissue chronograph from a few years back. And, you know, I kind of have a renewed love affair with this one again. So, you know, it had been quite a while. I haven't worn that watch in, oh gosh, it's probably been, you know, close to a year before I ever had it out of the box. Yeah. And every time I look at it, I mean, it's never, I never think like, oh, I should sell this cause I don't wear it much. Cause I absolutely adore it. I just have found that, you know, wearing a lot of titanium watches, whether it's the CWN1 or, you know, the FXD, which I wear most of the time, the Deep Star is just it's a big, heavy steel chronograph, kind of thick, and it's heavy on the wrist. And so the strap that I actually put it on that I came to find quite comfortable was, if you remember the Garmin Mark, the Generation 2 kind of adventure version, came with a rubber strap, and then it came with a leather strap that's backed with rubber, and it's quite nice.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that strap.
Has this like quick release, you know, it just clicks onto the spring bar, and it happens to be 22 millimeters, which is what the Garmin is. And I wear the Garmin every time I work out, but I wear it on the rubber strap. And so this strap wasn't getting worn, and it works really well on the Deep Star. It's a good fit. You know, the Deep Star looks good on leather, being kind of a vintagey looking chronograph. And so that's how I've got that one these days. And that's what I've got on today.
Nice. Yeah, that's a goodie. Yeah, for me, I'm wearing the Arkan Alterum, my Vancouver speakeasy. They're launching or have launched by the time this episode comes out, kind of the next wave of a colorway for the Alterum, which is steel with like a sage green dial.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it at the Vancouver show. There's a photo of it in my Hood and Key photo report from the Vancouver show.
Yeah.
And then they've started to communicate on that. I think it's one of the best colorways. I think green is an exceptionally difficult color to do well, like in a way that I like. I'm either very picky or maybe green is just not for me.
Yeah.
But I do really like this green. It's not overly olive sort of drab sort of military, and it's not that like very radiant sort of take that you get from a lot of the big Swiss brands
mm-hmm.
that go for this very verdant sort of deep grass, emeraldy sort of color. This is much more like it says, sage. It has this kind of balanced brownish gray tone in it that I really like as well. So a goodie for sure. But I'm wearing my Vancouver speakeasy one, which has the green case, the Cerakote case, black dial, and the kind of gold sand colored GMT hand for yeah. second time zone hand.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah.
And it was one of these weekends, and look, we can jump right into it if we want, but it was one of these weekends where I did want to track at least one other time zone, given the AP Swatch launch sort of scenario. So by now, this is all old news. We don't really need to fill everybody in on it, but Swatch has done a bioceramic AP pocket watch called the Royal Pop. It essentially leaked to such an extent that they ended the embargo early last week. So by the time you're listening to this, probably like 8-9 days before, but a good 5 or 6 days before the real embargo, which was supposed to be Saturday, the 16th. And all the stories came out, and of course, people who are wanting it to be a Royal Oak were disappointed. And I think a lot of watch enthusiasts were going like, what would I do with this? Mm-hmm. Well, that was kind of the conversation I was happening with the type of people who like the sort of watches that I like. But on a grander scope, an absolutely massive thing for AP to put their name on.
Yeah.
And you can argue the value of putting their name on it. And of course, there's some fallout with how the launch went on Saturday because a lot of people really wanted one of these. But the power of AP putting their name on it, I think, is more of a statement than Omega, which is part of the Swatch group. AP, of course, isn't. It's an independent brand. Jason, like, from a product standpoint, I feel like you and I are probably aligned. This is nothing for me. Like, that doesn't do anything. It has no appeal. Like, yeah. I understand why it's important and why it speaks to a group of people and why it probably speaks to a younger and more female audience than you and I would represent.
Mm-hmm.
But like, did you see any of these and go, oh yeah, I could see standing in line or not for one?
No. And I think, you know, definitely a bold move to kind of release it as a pocket watch with a lanyard. And, you know, I've been saying for, you know, I don't know, the better part of 5 or 6 years that I always felt like pocket watches were going to make a comeback. I kind of did that tongue in cheek, but, you know, we've seen a few things kind of pop up in the past few years, and you know, Christopher Ward's done some, and some other brands, mainly kind of limited kind of wink wink sort of pocket watches. But for this one to kind of blow up this big, I kind of left me scratching my head. It's just nothing that interests me personally. I can't say that even a standard kind of wristwatch version of the Royal Oak would have compelled me to go out and buy it. And I think, you know, the colorways are very many of them, at least, are very bubblegum, you know, kind of really loud, interesting kind of color combinations, pop art sort of stuff. So yeah, zero interest for me. And then I feel like, you know, the way the launch was handled was not great. And a lot of publicity around that just kind of, you know, wasn't doing either of the brands that collaborated here many favors. And it just felt kind of a bit kind of strange and out of touch and not my thing. I guess we'll see what transpires going forward, you know, what they do in the future around this. Hopefully some lessons have been learned.
I don't know. We don't like to be negative. If we feel negatively about something, that kind of ruins the fun of being into watches, and we don't really, that would just be something I'd kind of turn my back on and move away.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I do think that Swatch probably had the data they needed after multiple Omega launches and the Blancpain launch to know that this would be big and would put a huge amount of stress on the stores that were carrying it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of the comms maybe didn't make it clear that these wouldn't be impossible to buy in the future. et cetera. I mean, I think I'm not the, this isn't a novel take from old James here, but like, why not sell most of them online and prevent this kind of fallout?
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if it's not fallout, just a scenario that I don't think is what Swatch would have wanted, with stores having to close, with staff being, you know, in stressful scenarios, with people on the street being in stressful scenarios. All of that feels like it could have been avoided if they had offered even some of the colors online. Like, I understand maybe do one or two that are boutique only.
Mm-hmm.
I understand wanting people to come to the store and wanting this moment to be yours.
Yeah.
But also, you know, just to use the example, I recently got in line late at night to buy the Delhi Watch Company DWC Terra. Do you know this watch, Jason?
No, I don't.
I'll have a story on it once I eventually get it. I'll get it at some point. So this is a little titanium watch from Delhi Watch Company. Field style, very sort of modern tech looking. I really like it. I thought it was a cool idea. It's also like $45 or $50. Like, I think all in, I was in for like 80 Canadian for this watch. And I was just curious because there was a huge amount of interest. And I thought, well, you know, the company was saying we might have 35 to 40,000 people trying to buy a few thousand watches. Yeah. I thought, well, that's notable. Let's see how they do it. And I thought it worked out really well. I entered like a storefront and then at a given time, I was allowed through a gate. As I went through this sort of digital gate, I was given a randomized number and that was my number in line. And you had until that number decreased to zero to prep and be ready to like to get your credit card out. I think I waited 11 minutes as my number went from 3,800 to zero in line.
Yeah.
And then I quickly just went with Apple Pay or PayPal, I don't remember, one or the other, and checked out. And it worked out really nicely. And I think you can handle huge demand. I don't know how many people actually tried to buy the watch, and I'll dig in for a deeper story once I get the watch eventually.
Yeah.
But I'll throw it in the show notes. It's a cool little thing. I thought the design was cool. I thought the story behind it was cool. And then I wanted to experience the sort of retail scenario of how you sell this many watches. Because look, like Hodinkee has battled bots and other things like that for limited editions in the past. You have to be able to think your way through that.
Yeah.
And maybe one of those options is to sell things at brick and mortar retail. But I think Swatch learned that, I don't know, like I went down to the Toronto line and the majority of the line were people there to buy to sell, or were trying to sell actively in the line to people walking by knowing what the line was for.
Wow. Yeah.
That was the majority of it. You know, I met a few guys in line. You know, the people at the front of the line in Toronto were buying to keep, but with the intention that in 10 or 15 years, this would be very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to disavow them of that idea, but I don't agree with that read on the idea. It's probably most valuable up until the product doesn't have lines.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seemed like most of the people I spoke to in line were there either to hold a position that they intended to sell to somebody closer to launch the next morning, or were actively like bartering for what a number for the watch might be. 1,000, 2,000 Canadian was the number when we were there. I'm not like, look, I know that this is part of the world economy for high demand goods, but watch enthusiasts have spoken very loudly that that's growth and we don't like it. And moreover, it's not just that that you'd say it's not going to happen. Anything that's in demand will have this sort of flipper vibe to it.
Yeah.
But like, give us some outlet to not have to be part of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know. I think it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. We saw it a ton in the comments, and you just go like, wouldn't we just be able to do this in a way where more people got the product, more money went to the charity that AP is supporting through it. The investments in watchmaking, I believe, is the current, like, we don't know exactly where the money's going, but they are donating their proceeds from the watch. And I think there's lots of good in this story here. And it just got marred by a scenario where watch enthusiasm had to butt up against a different type of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And I've said it before, and it's a difficult, nebulous thing to kind of get into, but money will never make something cooler. Ever.
Yeah.
It makes it less cool. And I think that's how it hit a lot of enthusiasts. And I think that's how a lot of enthusiasts feel about the auction world as well.
Yeah.
We're like, this is only about the money or the exclusivity or the fact that someone can have it and somebody else can't, which isn't really an open door for enthusiasm. You know what I mean? It's one thing if something's expensive and you can't buy it, but you can learn all about it. But when something's inexpensive and should be accessible, like a $400 Swatch, and you still can't get it because a bunch of people who don't even care about the watch want to make $2,000 on eBay, it's just a tough sort of thing for the enthusiast to sort of encapsulate. But you look at the numbers, and like, I think this is one of those scenarios where watch enthusiasts you know, there's a slice of them that are that would be in the market for something like this AP Royal Pop. And then that slice has to contend with a huge slice of people who want it for its more broad appeal, or it's, you know, the possible upside of flipping it, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's you know, as someone who's kind of known to friends and family and, you know, just other people about as being tangentially at least connected to the watch space as I am, you know, I was just getting, you know, people kind of consistently over the past few days, like, have you heard about this? What is this all about? And I'm like, I just roll my eyes. Do I really have to explain? Like, this is just not reflective of it's so bad when, like, the people that, you know, that are outside of kind of our space that, you know, are
that this little, is their experience.
Yeah, exactly. Like they think that this is how the watch world works. And like this one story that pops up with this bad news, is what they want to ask questions about. It's kind of a bummer, but,
yeah. And I think it's when you invite a certain non-enthusiast group or a sort of group going directly for a value upside, a flipping, a cash, that sort of thing, that it changes the whole tone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's not part of the generalist watch enthusiasm, especially since like the crypto boom, but I think this highlights it more because it's about an inexpensive product becoming inaccessible.
Yeah.
Because of the attention, because of the profile.
Well, speaking of Swatch Group collaborations among enthusiast groups, we have another watch to talk about here that might be a little more interesting to our crowd. You want to introduce this one a bit? It looks like we're lo and behold, TGN is right on the cutting edge of an embargo lift when this episode goes up.
I think anybody who's really into video games these days and anybody who's really into Omega, the writing's been on the wall for this watch for a little while, but as of when this episode launches, the embargo lifts for the new Omega Seamaster Diver 300M Chronograph 007 First Light. So let me make it really clear. This is a real version of a watch that's based in a video game called 007 First Light. The video game comes out May 27th on whatever system you want to play. It's made by the same people who made Hitman. So if you're roughly my age and you remember the absolute incredible time loss that happened in your life playing Hitman 2 or 3, that bodes really well. This is one of these games where if I was in a video game playing mode, I would be waiting for it. I'd be very excited to play it. I really like these developers. I like the types of games they make. The idea is that it's a Bond story where I believe Bond's in his late or mid to late 20s and he's earning his 00 status in this story. So you can go online and watch YouTube videos about the gameplay. You can even go online and watch YouTube videos that show this watch. But now the watch is a real thing.
Hmm.
It is a 44 millimeter stainless steel Seamaster chronograph. It has some coloring with a PVD bronze gold rings and a black ceramic bezel and pushers. It's quite a contrasty thing. I think it actually looks very Bond. Like, I think it works in the scope. It's on sort of a new colorway of the No Time to Die NATO, which is black and then gray mid centers and then a gold center or a sandy sort of center, which is, I guess, based in the First Light coloring or based in the watch itself. And then it comes in the same sort of suitcase that's shown in the game.
Hmm.
So if you're really into the game, this could be quite a meaningful thing.
Yeah.
We wanted to talk about it because there's been just so much chatter about Bond and no real movement.
Yeah.
About what's happening next. Obviously, this is our first one with MGM, Amazon kind of managing it. And we have Denis Villeneuve will be the director, but Bond has not been announced. And we're at a point now where Omega, who, of course, a huge part of their broad scope marketing is tied to Bond, is going into like a video game to make a moment, which I don't disagree with. There's a chance. I mean, if this is a very, very successful video game,
mm-hmm.
and the next Bond doesn't do that well, there's a chance this is a more profitable, valuable property.
Oh, sure.
Than the next Bond. You never know. But video games are a much larger business than movies or television.
Yeah.
I think this is something we'll see more. We've seen other Swatch groups like Hamilton have done video game tie-ins with Black Ops and with, I'm forgetting what that other game is called. I haven't played it. And those are huge franchises. Like Call of Duty is worth more than Bond, all of Bond.
Really? Wow. That's amazing.
Going all the way back. I wrote a story when that watch came out, the Black Ops Hamilton chronograph, which is you can have it in the game. I think it's either DLC or something you can earn or a character skin, that sort of thing. And you can buy the same watch. It's a nice little Hamilton. It's a little overpriced for what it was, but it's a nice little Hamilton field watch. But I'm pretty certain that the, you can go back and read that story and then disagree in the comments if you want to. But I'm fairly certain that factored for inflation and everything, you could make the case that Call of Duty is worth significantly more than Bond.
Amazing.
And yeah, so I think this is something we'll see more of. I think it's notable that Omega's doing it. But Jason, how does maybe we start with the watch and then we'll get to whether or not the video game is meaningful in any way to you. But what do you think of the watch? I mean, it's a colorway, I guess, of an existing product.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not a video game person, so I can kind of pull that out of my impression and just kind of take it for the watch itself. I think it's a handsome piece, and I think it's significant also that, if I'm not mistaken, you have it in our notes here, it's the first ever chronograph in the Bond Seamaster Diver lineup. So, you know, Bond has always kind of just worn the straight up, you know, going back to the Brosnan era, just a standard time and date piece or time only in the case of No Time to Die. And this is a chronograph, and it's a handsome chronograph. It's big, 44 millimeters in steel. That I have no doubt that'll be a very heavy watch. It's curious too that the buckle on the NATO strap is titanium, whereas the watch case itself is steel. But you know, whatever. But one thing I like about this movement, this is the caliber 9900 iteration of a chronograph caliber that Omega's been making for a few years. I do like that the elapsed time subdial has the hours and the minutes, you know, like a read off like a clock, which I've always found to be a really nice, easy to read kind of chronograph subdial. So that's great. And yeah, I like the colors. I like the use of that bronze gold. I think it plays off well and against the kind of the black wave dial. It's a nice looking piece. But again, Omega must be doing some kind of get some feedback or research, or internally they just love big watches, but 44 millimeters feels a little out of step these days. But you know, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. I think it's a big watch. I'm not sure that it's one of these ones that's meant for like the core of the audience. And obviously it's Omega. They make a watch for everybody. And maybe this is just the one that suited the, a tie-in in the video game. I can include some videos of the integration into the video game. Maybe it made sense to have the chronograph for a mechanic of some sort in the game, which is very cool. Mm-hmm. And also it definitely makes sense for Bond to want a chronograph. I mean, how many Bond movies or movies that kind of are inspired by the world of Bond, like a Mission Impossible, come down to the last couple seconds?
Yeah. So true.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think it makes sense. I actually think these are really good looking watches. The standard one, mm-hmm. On the rubber strap, I really like. I think that the skeleton hands for me make more sense on the chronograph. I've enjoyed these watches in previous versions.
Yeah.
Especially if you go back to the late 90s, early 2000s, the kind of that steely flat blue with mm-hmm. the red accents. I thought that was a great looking watch. Definitely the kind of thing that was on like my dream list at one point. But they do wear a little big. I think this one is, it's 17 millimeters thick, 17.2.
Wow.
21 millimeter lugs. It is 53 millimeters for 52.8 across like north, south. Mm-hmm. So that's a big watch.
Yeah.
You're going to need a big wrist for it. Maybe they're hinting that they know that the next Bond is an extra burly version of Bond.
Yeah.
Or maybe this is also just the sort of watch that somebody wears a slightly larger size of, and it's not always for the wrist. I don't know the last time I had one of these in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've actually ever seen or strapped one on of the current chronograph collection, the Seamaster 300. And yeah, pricing on the standard models on a strap is $9,200. So, I mean, I think right in the world of what Omega charges for a fully, high-end chronograph movement and a dive watch all in one, really not surprising at this point from a price point standing. The watch is one thing. I think it'll be perfectly successful. And I think you get a wide leash with a Bond integration. It doesn't have to be this like core enthusiast. It can be a 45 millimeter Planet Ocean.
Yeah.
And people can still go nuts for it if it feels like the right sort of thing for Bond. And I think this feels like a Bond-esque sort of watch.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be a wild thing to see him wear with a suit, but with a commando sweater and the sleeve rolled up. Yeah, why not? Right.
Yeah, right.
I think it's a good looking thing for sure. I think what's maybe more notable is one, the world of Bond is in such a state currently of unknowns. I'm not saying that they can't pull it off. Villeneuve's one of the best directors in the world. They'll have plenty of money. But it's in such a state of unknown that any rumor, anything that happens is of note. And I think it's cool that they decided to go, well, there's going to be this hopefully incredible game from a great studio with great Bond gameplay, like something that'll really you know, maybe it's not going to be GoldenEye in 1996 all over again. And we won't all be playing this with our friends in our basements, you know, again, hinting at maybe my age versus Jason's. But I think this could be a cool moment. And I like that. Yeah, it's inexpensive. It's an Omega. It's not a cheap watch. It's not an inexpensive watch. But I like that it's a cool thing that's maybe tied to the game. And maybe if nobody playing the game even goes out and buys it necessarily, it is a touch point where they'll remember it. You know, it reestablishes that Omega Bond connection, which we haven't had because we've waited kind of so long for the next Bond to understand how he'll fit the brand and all these sorts of things.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, when you're kind of, you know, in the desert, any drop of water is appealing. And I think, you know, we've been waiting for anything Bond related for quite some time. And this kind of popping up kind of reminds you of that kind of universe. And I did read something a couple of weeks ago that said that they've started the casting. So, you know, they brought in, casting directors by name or anything like that, but they did mention that they brought in one of the better kind of casting directors to kind of start that search. So we'll see, you know, the speculation about who's going to be the next Bond will start to ramp up, and the rumor mill will start cranking up, and it'll be fun to watch. But this feels like a bit of a kickoff for that. And I think, look, for all any little nitpicky criticism about the size of the watch or whatever else, or the price, it's a cool looking piece. I mean, I'll take a big chunky, sporty Omega dive chronograph any day. I think it's good looking, and it's worthy of us talking about.
Yeah, and like if it was $2,000 more because it's in a Bond video game, come on, right? Mm-hmm. But if it's a couple hundred bucks, like this is luxury watches. That's really that crazy in the world we live in. And yeah, just to be clear, that they've hired Nina Gold, who is the cast Game of Thrones is probably the thing that most people would know. So it should be interesting in Game of Thrones, notably a lot of British actors.
Yeah.
That's noteworthy as well. Look, if we can change gears entirely and you'll allow me to ramble a little bit more, you want to talk a little bit about this Wild Vacheron trip I went on last week?
Yeah, I'm really curious about that. And I think if it's leading where I think it is, I think it'll segue into something that I wanted to talk about a little later well. Okay. So how was that? You've been quite quiet about it. I'm really curious to hear how it went.
Yeah, so obviously I've been doing this for a very long time. I've been going on press trips since 2012, and I've never been on one like this, and that's because it wasn't a press trip. I got invited by a Vacheron. I'd been kind of kicking around the idea of, like, could I take the Cardinal Points, my current dream watch, which I've talked a lot about, and at this point I'm not even sure I can be unbiased. I just like the watch. As an enthusiast, this represents a dream watch for me. But I was kind of kicking around ideas like, could we take one diving? Could we take one hiking? Could we take it climbing? Could we kind of take it out into the wild and do something that probably most people aren't going to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And Vacheron said, look, we've got something coming up. It's not really for press. But if we can make some space, do you want to come to Utah to put the watch, you know, quote unquote, through its paces? And I said, yeah, sure. Let's figure that out. So it turns out it's not that easy to get to southern Utah, very, very close to northern Arizona.
Hmm.
And then the hotel that they've got their clients for this, you know, client event is the Amangiri, one of the best hotels in the world. I believe certainly one of the most striking from an architectural standpoint. I've been to Amangani in Wyoming for, the launch of the Rolls-Royce Cullinan. That gives you an idea of sort of the profile.
Yeah.
But, you know, Vacheron had a piece of the hotel kind of reserved for this event, and so we got there. They had given me two options. I could go on a hike around this surrounding area, which is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been, this sort of desert mesa scenario, or the other option was this Via Ferrata experience. And Via Ferrata, for those who don't know, is essentially, it's a climbing style experience. It's done, a lot of the Europeans listening will go, isn't this a common thing? It is and it isn't. In Italy, you might come across a Via Ferrata just on a trail, which would be essentially a ladder of metal rungs stuck into the rock to help you get over a steep part. In some places, they've taken it to kind of a new level of extreme where you are clipped in, you have a harness, and you're using sort of a double clip system, so you're always on a steel cable that runs next to the rungs of the ladder. And so they said it was fairly intense, but a lot of fun, quite vertical. We went up sort of one side of a prominent exposure and then across like a 300-foot wire bridge over a 400 or 500 foot drop, and then down the other side into like a gully of a canyon, and then walked back to the hotel.
Oh, nice.
And I remember before we were going, I said, so we're climbing around, and I brought my CWN1, kind of expecting them to be like, yeah, you can't take a $40,000 watch on this climbing excursion where you're literally like hands on rock and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
They gave me a white Cardinal Points at my request with the orange strap. And I said, can I wear this on? And they said, oh, absolutely. Everybody's going to be. And so a bunch of the owners had already taken delivery of theirs and wore them on the climb.
Oh, sure.
And I'll be honest, like if I had worn my Pelagos on this, I would have felt like I was abusing it. Just to give you a baseline.
Yeah.
You are sucked up against the rock. I definitely scratched up the buckle on the Vacheron. I don't believe I damaged the case or crystal or anything like that. But it definitely was about as tough a physical thing as I've done in several years.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a pretty wild and difficult thing. I think my leg stopped hurting 2-3 days ago mostly probably from the down climb. I think I blew out my quads on that one. But yeah, it was a delight to get a chance to really kind of, again, the watch was soaked in sunscreen and sweat. And like I said, if it had been like, I flat out wouldn't have done any of this with, say, my Nomos.
Oh, sure.
It would have felt too abusive, too kind of hardcore. And you know, the folks from Vacheron, up to and including their president, the U.S. president who's there, were adamant, like, this is how we designed the watch. This is, you know, Corey Richards, who we've had on the podcast before. He was there kind of hosting the event. And he was like, yeah, I mean, this is a watch we designed in 2019 to be fully capable of an Everest push. He's like, we're not going to do anything in the next couple of days that it can't handle. But it is, you know, they acknowledge that it's, you know, it's kind of a weird thing to do, maybe not just with a Vacheron, but with a watch of that sort of caliber.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other notes. Weirdly enough, you know, Jason, several times in the past, I've mentioned Anthony Jeselnik. He does the book club that I like. He's a stand-up comedian I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
He was on the trip as a client.
Oh, wow.
So I got to meet him. He was on the climb with me, which was very cool. Given that Hodinkee doesn't specifically cover like the world of luxury necessarily, we obviously have luxury watches and occasionally we do like photo reports from events that would be in that world, like F1 or that sort of thing. But outside of that, an exceptionally strange and rare, you know, opportunity to see how the client side of this works. Like if you're a big enough client of a brand like Vacheron, you could get invited to something like this. And it was fascinating. It was really cool to just kind of spend some time with the watch, like a more meaningful than a couple hours. Because I think my other option to do a hands-on was going to be maybe a couple hours at the office in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
But instead, I was able to see all four of the new colorways. I was able to see a 2021 prototype, which I have photos of. I'll have a whole hands-on experience thing with Hodinkee soon. And I was able to see Corey's sort of long-standing chronograph.
Mm-hmm.
Version of the Everest chronograph that he's been wearing for years and years at this point. So it was cool to see some of those things. Corey's keen to be back on the show. He said to say hi to everybody listening. It was a busy schedule for him as sort of the host and center of the event to try and get away from some of his things to chat for an hour or whatever. But he said he'd be keen to be on in the next few episodes. So stay tuned for that. Obviously fun to catch up with Corey. But yeah, at this point, I feel like I've actually spent some meaningful time with that watch. And it's definitely, that is without a doubt, the hardest I've ever treated a luxury watch. The only thing that came to my mind was, you remember your story of climbing, I want to say it was in the Bugaboos with the Explorer 2?
Yeah, that was Via Ferrata as well. Yeah, and I remember having the same feeling of,
and like, you scratched that watch up, right?
Yeah, and I remember having that same feeling. I mean, you know, there's a lot of sports that are okay with wearing watches, climbing, you know, nice watches, but climbing is not. Rock climbing, you know. I mean, I suppose Everest might be a little different thing. You've got, you know, maybe it's under a glove and it's largely snow and ice. But yeah, rock climbing, like you're sticking your arm against in a crevice in some cases, or just casually just moving around rocks, it just feels very unfriendly towards luxury watches. But that's really cool. And I'm curious, like, so how many of the clients joined for that? Because I'm envisioning kind of the typical Vacheron client, if they're kind of repeat customers. I don't want to be unkind, but maybe not the most outdoorsy, sporty type, if they're kind of typically going for more of the high end, dressier, complicated watches.
I think the Cardinal points kind of brought that out in people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, anybody who felt like they were below a certain line in their mind could go on the hike. And it turns out the hike was very difficult. So nobody really got out scot-free from a bit of sweat. So everybody was pretty dialed. And it was a really nice group of people who were just kind of there for an adventure. And like I said, the majority of them, like I got most of the way up the first kind of push.
Yeah.
So you're maybe a couple hundred meters above the, on sort of a, the nose of a formation
mm-hmm.
where they have this sort of route and it feels like you're going straight up.
Yeah.
And then if you look back, it feels like you're really going straight up.
Yeah. Yeah.
This pitch. And the gentleman behind me, who's a director, his name is David. He's a TV show director, that sort of thing. I said, "Oh, you're wearing one too." And he goes, "Yeah, yeah. I just got delivery of it a few days ago. So I was obviously going to bring it on this trip."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Man, that's pretty baller."
Yeah. Good for you. Yeah. That's great.
As far as the watch goes, I would say the main thing I learned is it's a little on the big side on paper, but once it's on your wrist, especially on the bracelet, I swear it's smaller than the CWN one.
Huh.
In almost every dimension.
Yeah.
It wears really nicely. Looks great. Looms fantastic, as I was happy to learn.
Wow.
And then weirdly, I think after spending time with all four of the colors now, I think I've kind of like rearranged which one I prefer.
Huh.
Weirdly, it's the brown might be the one. The white's awesome. The blue is so classic Vacheron, and it's the closest to the kind of purpley gray blue of the original from 2021.
Yeah.
But then that brown, if this makes sense, it's the least brown watch I've ever worn around.
Yeah.
And it's such a nice match for the titanium. And in some lights, there's like a purplish red hue, just ever so slight in it.
Yeah.
But the brown is very gray in a tonal fashion. So it just, especially on the bracelet, it looks fantastic in the brown.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that this is consumer advice. Like, I can't go out and tell you to buy a $40,000 watch because, it's just an unbelievable amount of money for a watch, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of outside the scope of what we normally chit-chat about. But as far as a dream watch goes, you know, we've talked about Royal Oak Offshore Divers in the past and Ploprofs and that sort of thing. And in my mind, it kind of slots into that sort of pantheon up there with the some of the wild Blancpain creations and that sort of thing, where you go like, oh, this is a different thing, and it comes from a brand that doesn't usually do this. Like titanium's not Vacheron Constantin's forte.
Yeah,
but I do think they just did such a good job with it, and you know, it comes from starting with a pretty solid watch to begin with the Overseas Dual Time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is one that'll be on the dream list, the lottery list, even for a long time. So again, I don't have any like hardcore buying advice. If you have the money and you can get in line for one, I have a doubt you won't absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, you know, my collection all totaled probably isn't worth half of what this watch costs.
Yeah,
so
wow yeah, that's great that you got to spend time with it in such a kind of a cool way to use it too. I mean, I think, you know, in office kind of, or you know, around the house sort of hands-on is one thing, but to be able to take it out and see other people using it, you know, actual owners using it that way is encouraging.
And if they had loaned me one, I wouldn't have had the guts to like even take it on like a hike to Jefferson Forest like you and I went on with Sarah when you were here, like, which is just a walk in a park, basically.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
The thing that was really ridiculous is I don't know that area of the world very well, that sort of Arizona, southern Utah, desert mesa vibe. And I just like it's absolutely jaw dropping out there. I don't have any specific need to get back to that hotel, but I would absolutely go back to that area and car camp, or you know do an overlander sort of thing.
Yeah.
I was blown away by the scenery and the verticality and the colors, and it's just so different from where I grew up.
Was it warm? Was it hot?
Very. Yeah. I think we were over 40 Celsius on the when we came down on the hike.
Yeah,
we were just kind of baking on the rocks for sure. It was one of those like lots of sunscreen days. I had the shout out David, my connect at Arc'teryx, but I had this Arc'teryx sun shirt I got last year, which is like one of my favorite things because it's weightless. You cannot tell you're wearing anything, but it's like really good sun cover, and you have the hood. So I had like the hood, the helmet that you had to wear.
Yeah,
the full getup and the big glasses, and then like any bit of skin that was especially on my face was just like white with the like mineral sunscreen. I'm not sure I'll publish any photos of me in the story on the side of the mountain.
Yeah,
but it was cool, and it was nice to meet a few people. Obviously, a very weird, almost parasocial thing to meet Anthony Jeselnik on the trip. Yeah. Not something I expected, but even some of the other folks that we kind of hung out with for the 36 hours of the event or so, mm-hmm. they were all very interesting people who weren't necessarily like, kind of like what you were positing, not exactly what I expected of Vacheron's clients.
Yeah.
Way more people took up the Via Ferrata experience than I expected.
Hmm.
So we'll have a story about that on Hodinkee in the future. It'll be largely a hands-on with the watch. I've got a ton of photos to get through and that sort of thing. But yeah, that's the update from one of the weirder trips I've ever had, or more uncommon. Maybe weird's the wrong thing, because it was a lovely trip, but just uncommon sort of. The last time I felt like kind of that level of experience would have been Lange with Villa d'Este, Concorso dell'Eleganza back in 2017, 2018. Yeah. And that is also a, sort of a once in a lifetime trip. So
yeah,
there you go. And apparently it's a couple year wait for a Cardinal points if you'd like to get in line.
All right, time to start saving.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, start saving, bank robbing for sure.
Yeah, right,
all that kind of stuff. But I kid. If I get caught, I kid. I wouldn't steal from a bank and get caught. There you go. So it was quite a bit of travel down, and then I got back Friday morning, like literally, I think my plane landed at 6 a.m. in Toronto, and kind of immediately started packing for the cut, like unpacking one bag, packing for the cottage to try and get up there Saturday morning to make the most out of the weekend. So it's been kind of go. And I now I'm home for a week. I go to New York next week. So we'll do the beer and pizza hangout at Watches of Switzerland the final Thursday of May, which is the 28th. So if you're listening and you're keen on that, just pay attention to Hodinkee. We are running an RSVP this time because it was way too busy last time for the store. So we are running an RSVP this time. So just pay attention there and get your name on that list. It's not a small RSVP. It's a good group of people. It won't be quite as insane as what we did in March, which was a little bit unwieldy, if you will.
Yeah, you don't want the AP swatch sort of scenario. People line up around the block fighting to get a spot inside or anything like that.
So. I believe we will see increased sensitivity in retail activations in terms of making sure people don't have sort of a negative experience. For sure.
Right.
Anyways, that's a lot of James talking.
And we can start to kind of segue into final notes. And I guess a couple of notes I wanted to talk about are, in essence, sort of final notes. I think it's a good segue from your discussion about Corey Richards and the Vacheron trip and the Via Ferrata, in that I guess as of we're recording this 9 days ago, the 10th of May would have been the 30th anniversary of the Everest tragedy that was the subject of John Krakauer's book Into Thin Air. And we've talked about Krakauer in the past, and we both are big fans of his writing and Eiger Dreams and Under the Banner of Heaven, and he's just such a phenomenal writer. And kind of as a tie into the kind of mountaineering climbing culture, I had a chance to kind of listen to a couple of interviews with him in the past week. One of which was an interview that was done through the 92nd Street Y in New York. They run kind of series of talks. And in this case, it was Krakauer being interviewed by David Gran, who wrote Lost City of Z and The Wager and several other great nonfiction books. And I have to say, I signed up for it and paid $20 to kind of sit in on this streaming interview, and it was fairly disappointing, I guess I would say. I think Krakauer, his delivery during that talk felt a little jarring, a little bit. He felt a little, I don't want to say addled, but a little anxious or something. And Gran wasn't the best interviewer in my mind, so I was left wanting more and kind of a little bit disappointed. But then a few days later, I stumbled upon a really good interview with Krakauer by none other than Alex Honnold. And I discovered Alex Honnold's podcast that he does with Fitz Cahal, who is an editor at Outside Magazine and another climber. And it's called Climbing Gold. And if you're into climbing or even climbing adjacent kind of culture, it's a worthy podcast to listen to. I've listened to a couple now. Walking the Dog recently, I listened to one where Honnold interviews Charlize Theron about her climbing experience in the movie Apex, which is out on Netflix now. Bit of a guilty pleasure. I watched that movie recently, and it's kind of a fun.
And what'd you think?
Fun viewing. Nothing to write home about, but fun. It was outdoorsy and
bit of a crime 101 scenario.
Yeah, exactly right. So, but Honnold's interview with Krakauer was really good. It's an hour long, and they really kind of dig deep. And it was a well edited show. Krakauer seemed a little calmer. I think talking to one of his peers in the climbing space kind of helped. And the impression I get, you know, coming away from it was I remember reading Into Thin Air, you know, first as a story in Outside Magazine, and then when it turned into the book and, you know, kind of back in the day. And it still resonates. I've pulled the book off my shelf. I'm planning on rereading it here shortly. You know, Krakauer, along with Sebastian Younger, were just two incredible influences on me as I was kind of coming of age as someone who was an aspiring writer. And to this day, I still enjoy following them both. And Krakauer has kind of stepped away from writing as of about 10 years ago, he said. He has kind of come to dislike writing and kind of the life that it has meant for him. He's spent a lot of time defending himself, as well as he suffered from some pretty serious PTSD from all of the death that he witnessed on Everest back in 96. And he talks about all of that. He talks about the writing life. He talks about being an introvert. He talks about, you know, kind of the blowback that he got from that book. And then also Into the Wild and you know, the Pat Tillman story and Under the Banner of Heaven. I mean, he's just got this incredible lineup of books that he's written, and he's just such a talent. Mm-hmm. And yet he comes across as this very honest, very flawed human being. And I really appreciated that about him. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I mean, we can call it a final note, and we'll put a link to that podcast in the show notes. But it's definitely worth listening to.
I'm glad you added the one with Alex Honnold. I definitely would like to give that a listen.
It's really
I think
good.
The last time I dug into Krakauer, he was also talking about some of the pain that he had experienced in writing and how he kind of didn't like it or want to do it anymore. And I found it kind of sad, and I kind of stepped away from tracking some of it. Some of it, you know, obviously he's a guy that's dealt with a lot of controversy surrounding mm-hmm. his, you know, his coverage of various events and his opinion on other events. You know, it's a shame that that's had that sort of an impact on him. But I you could definitely feel it even a few years ago. So
yeah.
Hopefully Alex is able to get something a little bit more core personality out of him.
Yeah, it was really good. And then just kind of moving on to kind of another tragedy that's far fresher. It's these deaths of these cave divers or these divers in the Maldives that's still playing out these days. You know, for those unfamiliar, there were five Italian divers that were diving to, you know, close to 200 feet deep in a cave underwater in the Maldives. None of them made it out alive. And so there's been a lot of activity around recovering bodies. And there was a Maldivian Navy diver who died during a recovery effort. So now they've brought in a couple of kind of crack cave divers from Finland to help out with the recovery. And as I was reading the story about this and kind of following this, I realized that these were two guys that were kind of the main figures in that documentary that was probably a final note or something years ago called Diving Into the Unknown. So I rented that last night. It was 99 cents on Apple TV. This was the story about this team of Finnish divers that were diving a cave in remote Norway in the winter and lost two of their colleagues who kind of had become trapped in a very narrow obstruction and actually blocked the way through the cave, and then they went back to recover the bodies. And it's quite a gripping, very sad story. I wouldn't say the movie is particularly great. I think it could use some better editing, but the story itself was quite good, and it was interesting to kind of see those guys in action, knowing that they're now assisting with the diver recovery in the Maldives. So not to you know, close out here our main topic stuff with a couple of downers, but I just felt like these were kind of relevant topics to some things that we've talked about in the past.
For sure. Yeah. No, I think that's a good one to cover and a decent one for final notes. Good story that's also developing and continues too. So it keeps it noteworthy and definitely kind of speaks into that diving pillar. Mine this week is actually just a TV show that Sarah and I have been really enjoying. We actually buzzed through the first season in probably less time than we've ever watched that much TV. So much so that it, you know, ruined my sleep for a couple of nights. So it's not a brand new show. It's actually, I believe, just finished its second season. It's called The Pit, and it's about the emergency room at a Pittsburgh hospital, which is, you know, the term they have for it is The Pit. And it's a really, really solid medical drama that plays out over the course of one shift. So every hour of TV show is an hour in real time in the ER. I would say it's so good that you tend to not even pay attention to that element until you get to the end of an episode and you go, oh my goodness, that's been an hour.
Huh.
I need to go to bed.
Yeah.
It's 12:30 And you go, I got to see one more. I got to know what's going on here. The first season was great. It's one of the more bingeable things I've ever watched. Fairly well written. I'm not a doctor, so I can't tell you how accurate it is. But it's definitely very watchable. It is not in the same vein necessarily as a Scrubs or a Grey's Anatomy. It's sort of a different thing. It's a little bit more serious, but at the same time, it has these moments of human warmth and kindness. And it's just nice. It's a good show. And the fact that Sarah also likes it means I'm not just there because it's quite gory at times, which is, of course, among my interests. Yeah. You know, I especially from a medical standpoint, it's fun to see some of these things shown in kind of quote unquote grave detail. Mm-hmm. So if you're squeamish on that sort of thing, there will be a few points where you look away from the screen for sure. But it is a really good show that I think kind of manages to extend beyond being just one thing. So if you're looking for it and you like the idea of a medical drama, they're two seasons in. I'll be done second season, you know, by the end of the week, I bet. And have been really enjoying it. It's called The Pit with two T's.
Yeah. Yeah. Christy and I watched a couple of episodes of the first season a little while back, and I'm eager to get back to it. I'm kind of a sucker for medical dramas, and, you know, they're right up there with police procedurals and heist films and that sort of thing. That's a good one. So, and it's got Noah Wiley, who was, you know, the star of ER, you know, I mean, he's kind of revisiting.
Yeah. He's great. The cast is solid. A lot of them feel like very real people. Or like versions of real people that you've met in your life, which is great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I will forever have a soft spot for House.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
House MD. Mm-hmm. But this is much more serious than that, a little bit less kind of medical mystery that, you know, maybe you get one of those in one of these shifts versus, you know, there's kind of every episode of House. We're not doing as much sleuthing and breaking into people's houses and that sort of thing. So different take, but one I've really enjoyed. So if you haven't seen it and it sounds interesting,
yeah,
cool. Jump in.
All right. Well, this turned into kind of a long episode for a little kind of catch-up session here. But yeah, it was good.
Sure did. Apologies for those of you who don't like a James ramble. That was a James ramble for sure.
Well, all interesting
but
stuff.
But it's been a busy week with lots to kind of chit-chat about.
All right. Well, as always, thanks so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly and jump in on the Slack, where we will be updating folks with news about our forthcoming Chicago meetup during Windup, and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout a siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Mahatma Gandhi, who said, "There is more to life than increasing its speed."